The modern world, as I see it, is like a key which has to be absolutely, if you're going to have a modern world, you have to have a key that fits exactly into the lock to unlock modernity. And all the parts of the key have to be right. If one bit is just wrong, you don't have enough economic growth, or you have too much religion or too little religion or whatever, it doesn't work. So you have to get all these parts together. That's one way to look at it. Another is that you have to complete the jigsaw puzzle, the different parts. Many academics tend to concentrate on one thing, on politics, on economics, on society, whatever. And I, as an anthropologist, think you should try and understand the whole in order to understand the parts. So through the lectures, I've been filling in bit after bit of the jigsaw puzzle of modernity, starting with what the question is, which is how did we get here, and then looking at the first industrial nation, Britain, and looking at the strong wars, the great trading nation, and the largest empire in history, the British Empire. The first agricultural revolution, which occurred in England in the 18th century, the first industrial revolution in the world, 18th century England, the first capitalist nation, England, from about 700 years ago, the very wealthy English material life, which is a sign of modernity, clothes, food, housing, advanced science, Newton, Boyle, and so on, a strange class structure, which was very open and competitive, and not based on birth. A strong culture revolving a lot around games and sports and hobbies and competing with people, which fitted with the class structure. A rather weak kinship system, characterized by sending children away from home very young, so they were brought up outside the home. And romantic love, they left home, they met someone, their parents didn't arrange the marriage, they fell in love. So companionate marriage. And a lot of friendship, because the people you interacted with through life was not based on your birth, but on the people you chose to be friends with. And this was tied to a very powerful civil society, that is, lots of groups of like-minded people who got together to form a company, to form a church, to form a sports club, which lay between the state and the individual, and which acted as a buffer or a protection against too much concentration of power in the centre. So you had a balanced constitutional monarchy and the first democracy, modern democracy in the world in England, and a rather light bureaucracy because most of government was done by the upper middle class, by the gentry. All this was based on a very powerful legal system which kept people in check, and all this was brought into an individual through an educational system, which was very strange, as I mentioned, sending children away to schools or to be servants or apprentices, so they learnt their character as well as knowledge in a rather confrontational way, that is, they argued, away from home, and a very flat language which doesn't recognise differences between male and female, or social class, and was universal. And finally, in the last lecture, a very early nation state. Now, nationalism in England dates from 1,000 years ago or more. People felt, we are English. And when it gets to the time of Shakespeare, that is quite late in the development of national sentiment in England. There are two more parts to fill in, which I'll do quickly. One is religion and one is the English character. And then I'll try and solve the whole jigsaw by moving all this through time and showing you how all this happened. So to start with religion, but perhaps there's one final thing I should remind you of. My definition of modernity is that you have in the middle an individual, me, Robinson Crusoe, the single individual who has different roles and statuses and associations or relations with his with religion as an institution or ideas, economics, politics, and society or family. This is the only unit which unifies all of them. In the majority of societies, all these are joined together. So, say the same group of people will be a religious, economic, social one. That's a tribal society. We now live in a world where religion is meant to be separated from politics, economy from society, that is capitalism, these from each other. And this is a very strange, tense kind of confrontation, which I'll try and fill in the last bit, which is religion, because in most societies, until very recently, in the West certainly, religion and politics were very closely tied together. They are in Islam and in most world religions. One of the necessities for the kind of modern world I'm interested in is that they're separated from each other. Politics and religion are separate. So in England, certainly after about the 16th century, that is 500 years ago, when we had our Protestant Reformation, in England a form of Christianity developed, which we call Lutheranism, after Martin Luther. And this was a rather mild form of Protestant faith. It rejected the Pope, and it put conscience within the individual. Decision-making was within the individual. And it largely broke the link between politics and religion. The Queen was still the head of the Anglican Lutheran Church, but she didn't really interfere with it much, and people were left to get on with their religion in one sphere, their politics in another. This led to freedom of religion. Another thing which I think is a very important gift of England to the world is the idea of the freedom of religion, which obviously was taken to America too. And this surprised foreigners, because if they came from France, Italy, Spain, there wasn't freedom of religion. You would be imprisoned and perhaps burnt if you disagreed with the religious teachings of the church, because the state and the church were one. So when a Frenchman came to England in the 18th century, he says, and you are aware, you say, of that great liberty of conscience and toleration which is enjoyed in England. And Montesquieu, the great philosopher, says, with regard to religion, as in this state, every subject has a free will and must consequently be either conducted by the light of his own mind. The number of sects is increased. A sect is a sub-part of religion, so Methodists, Baptists, Quakers, they are sects. Or as Rochefoucauld, another Frenchman, said, all religions are tolerated in England, not by law, but in fact. In my section on London, I've already referred to the chapels of the various sects he'd written about that. They are similarly tolerated in other parts of the kingdom. People could go to different kinds of churches if they wanted to, even though it was an Anglican society. And this was not to be found anywhere else in Europe. The result of this was that each person had their own opinion. You have individualism in social life, but also individualism in intellectual life. And indeed, they're so separate that it's very difficult to see what united them. What was the common call to religion in England? Rochefoucauld again says, the only point on which there is general agreement is that nearly every Englishman holds a different belief. All of them believe in some particular point peculiar to themselves. The English are known as eccentrics, and I'll come back to that later. But in religion, they're eccentric too. They all have different beliefs. The result, he says, is that the whole body, which is made up of these individual believers, believes in nothing at all. A 19th century American asked, but the religion of England, is it the established church, that's the Anglican church? No. Is it the sects? No. They're only some perpetuation of some private man's descent. So there is no uniform religion. On the other hand, it would be wrong to think from this that religion was always tolerant in England. It was from the after the Civil War, but at earlier periods there had been much religious fervour and some intolerance. And just in one period, interestingly, when the Catholics got back into power under Queen Mary, she brought back the Catholic intolerance and burnt a number of heretics, including a number of academics from my university, Latimer, Ridley, Cranmer, and others. But that was the only time, really, this happened in that extreme way. In a way, you can see religion as yet again another kind of game. I've made an analogy between law and games and politics and games, but the English really look on religion as a game. It's a game in which the purpose of the game is to lead a good life and to be moderately confident that your good life will lead you to be saved. But how you play the game, the rules are quite basic, like in all games. You mustn't pick up the football and so on. You mustn't do this and that. But within that, it's up to you how you play the game. And it's a religion which really lays most of its stress on only one part of religion. I was explaining to my friend Je, who is here, that in the West, an anthropologist would define religion as having four parts. It has rituals, the things you do to get in touch with heaven. You kill an animal and go through a certain set of actions. Religions in the West have rituals, they have ethics, they have how you should behave kind of rules. They have dogma, which is statements about the purpose of life, philosophical statements about why we're here, what is the meaning of suffering and pain and so on. And they have a belief in a single God. So all Western monotheistic religions have those four components, which is why for a Westerner, religion in China or Japan is very puzzling because it doesn't have any sort of thing that has all those four components. You have a lot of ritual in some parts of your religious system, ethics in another, Confucian ethics, Taoist rituals, whatever. But having said that, in English religion, the main stress is on ethics. Behaving well. This is what Puritanism is about, really, above all. Behaving well in relation to other people and behaving well in relation to God. Ritual is downplayed hugely. We're not very keen on too much burning of incense and kind of Roman Catholic rituals. We don't believe in it. In fact, we don't believe we can communicate with God except by your inner devotion and prayer. And dogma is up to the individual. You interpret it yourself. It's a matter of your own thought. So, as Hippolyte Taine, a Frenchman, said, English religion subordinates ritual and dogma to ethics. So, when and why did the struggle between the state and the church, which I've said was essential for the break, this break here, between religion and politics. When did this occur? Some believe that it was at the Protestant Reformation, which I mentioned in the 16th century. But in fact, if you look at English history, it's much older than that. It goes back to the 12th, 13th, 14th centuries. There's always a tension, the confrontation between one of our famous kings and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Becket, is just one example of it. But there were always a tension between the crown and the church. And the church never developed, it never became all-powerful as the Catholic Church did, or very, very powerful. It was always subservient to the political system, but also a strong check on it. I'll come back to this, but I mentioned that after the downfall of the Roman Empire, Europe developed four powerful institutions, which are, again, religion, politics, i.e. the church, the Christian church, politics, which is, in this case, the crown, the king, the kings, society, which in this case is the nobles and aristocracy, and the towns, the economy, townsmen, economy. So it's the same four divisions, really. And these were all forms, 300 or 400, 500 years in balance with each other. Modernity really lies out of that contradiction and balance between them. And in England, this balance was maintained, the tension between a quite a powerful church, which you can't really ignore, but is below the king, and the king who is separate. And above them all, and this is the fiction upon which English society rests, is the law. Everyone has to obey it. The religious people have to obey it. The politicians, the king, has to obey it. And in England, the church didn't become so powerful that it had a separate law. As Maitland, who I've referred to before, the great lawyer, a legal historian, says, the church never developed its own separate legal system. It just acted on the edge, existed on the edge of the normal legal system. Is this echoing, this thing a bit? Are you all right? It is echoing. I'm not sure what I can do about it. See if it goes on. So we never got a separate legal system as you do in Catholic Europe, with the church courts very powerful and then having the Inquisition and then handing people over to be burnt by the royal power. And you really never get a fusion between the royal power and the religious power that you get all over Europe. Now, all this may give you a feeling that religion is unimportant in England. In fact, it's very, very important. It's important as a background factor. I've discussed with some people on our trip here whether the fact that China, on the whole, really has no religion. It has separate religions. I know that a number of you are Christians and Buddhists and so on. But there is no overarching religion. Whether this is going to have a serious effect on the development of China in the future, and I'm not sure about that, but certainly the first modern society, which is in England, arose out of a very religious society. That is, religion is always there in the back. I had not really realized how important this was until two things. Because religion now, if you ask, if you take a survey of people in England now, most of them don't go to church, they don't care about religion, they don't say they're religious, much less so in America. But actually, it's always there in the background. And this came home to me, firstly, when I examined my own childhood and my education, and I found that all the time I was learning about religion indirectly, that it lies behind the poetry of England, the landscape of England, every village has a parish church, the philosophy of England, the art, the music, the architecture. Every branch of life actually is suffused. Religion comes into it, and it would be very difficult to understand England or any other such country if you didn't understand that they are deeply Christian in their heritage. On the other hand, it's a very, it's just a background, it's a colouring or a taste in the culture. Because God is not very intrusive. In the end, he was domesticated, he was almost put into a box. In fact, if you go to Trinity College, Cambridge, and you go to the chapel by Wren, which I expect some of you have been to, it's just a box, a very elegant box designed by Sir Christopher Wren, and that God is inside it, but he's not very strong in some ways. He is important in philosophy, in Descartes' philosophy, for example, as a first mover, but otherwise he's a background figure. In some ways, I sometimes explain to people that we have the idea that we need a God. That there is in human, we as humans need something to feel that there's something more to life than this material world. We need some reverential figure, and we need some explanation of pain and suffering. So we need something there. What is called, being called the God-shaped hole. If you don't have it there, you just have a hole. You have a materialistic world with nothing, no meaning to it. And I think the English answer or trick was to fill this hole, not to leave it open, which allows all sorts of fanatical fundamentalist elements to come rushing in and do crazy things like burning the Quran and so on. I'm alluding to something that's on the news at the moment. But we fill it with a very gentle, almost as I describe it, as cotton wool. It's just a substance which is holding it there and allowing different people to interpret as they wish. Now this is a luxury, that is a rather quiet, tolerant, individualistic religion, a luxury for this island because it is an island. From the very beginning, as I mentioned, Bede, the historian of England, when he wrote his ecclesiastical history of the English people in the 8th century, was already thinking of the English as being a separate religious grouping. And the Pope was far away, the kings were powerful, the Pope couldn't interfere in the way that he did all over the rest of Europe. And so you got developing up, and the Reformation is just a late development of this, a special brand of tolerant, pervasive religion, which led to some of our greatest poetry, like George Herbert or Milton. And you can't understand Shakespeare's plays or even Newton's science without understanding that Newton was a very religious man. So it's always there, and yet it doesn't, as it does in societies which are more fundamentalist, it doesn't interfere with life. You can get on. In other words, it's been split off. You can get on with your economic life without worrying about laws that prevent you from taking interest. You can get on with your social life without thinking that your father is your people, your ancestors. It just acts as a part of life. And I think that is part of this important balance.